We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we follow an annual 7-day bike race across Iowa, learn the history of the Ferris wheel, hear what former music executives are doing now after the collapse of the industry, and find out what it's like to take on a bully for the first time at age 33. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. The music industry has been suffering from workplace downsizing for years. Ever since Napster displaced CDs, record labels have been laying off high-level suits. As the newly unemployed masses contemplate career change, independent producer Eric Malinsky caught up with some former music industry executives to see how they've reinvented themselves.
Tom Werman was the kingmaker of hair bands. Motley Crue, Twisted Sister, Poison.
I took what was pop about those bands, and I tried to feature that and hide their weaknesses.
Working at CBS Records, Tom felt like a corporate rock star.
I remember standing in line to check in. Maybe there are three or four guys in line. They've all got Hart, Schaffner & Mark suits and briefcases, and they're looking at me in my jean jacket and long hair and motorcycle boots and saying, what is this guy doing here? And you're saying, ha, You should come out with me tonight, you sap. I was one of you. Now I'm liberated.
But as far as music fans were concerned, Tom was just another corporate suit. He was part of an industry that exploited artists and overcharged for albums. When the internet came along, people could download music for free, and they were sticking it to the man. The industry was really slow to adapt to this new technology. When profits dwindled, they downsized. Tom struggled to stay in music. A lot of people got laid off, like Kate Hyman, who worked at V2 Records.
I'd sold more records for that label than anybody else put together. But when they cut the budget, I was one of the people to go.
The first people to get fired were the mid-level execs who discovered and developed artists. Kate was famous for turning the underground DJ Moby into a global star.
When I first started, it was all about artist development. There is no such thing anymore. And anybody that tries to sign someone and mentions that word, you can walk out right away because they're lying.
Lisbeth Cassidy also saw the writing on the wall. She was a pop music publicist, but she was afraid to leave the industry. She didn't think she had other skills. Then she had an epiphany when she visited her mother in the hospital.
The women and men that were taking care of her at this hospital were fantastic, and she was getting ready to go, and you could tell, and the nurses knew, and one came in and they said, you know, Mrs. Cassidy, it's been an honor and a privilege to work with you, and I hope our paths cross again, you know, full well knowing that she was not going to make it through the night. So I walked out of that room and I thought, you know, when I'm done with the music business, I'm going to go become a nurse.
Her family thought she was nuts, and so did Lisbeth.
I mean, I could write a press release, I could pitch an artist, and I can get you booked on a TV show, but, you know, how to palpate your spleen, I don't know if I could do that.
But she did go to nursing school. And it turned out to be a pretty good fit.
You know, when people are ill, it's such a difficult time for them. And they might be anxiety-ridden or have depression or in pain or any number of emotions and feelings. And if you can just make their day just a tiny bit better, it's so rewarding.
You know, it's funny. I was just thinking, like, ironically enough, these skills you probably learned as a publicist. You know, you ever deal with a patient or with a family member and they say thank you and you say, please, compared to Mariah Carey?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That was a big question for all the former music execs. Do their skills translate? Kate Hyman has managed to stay in music by starting her own record label. It's called Little Monster. They make children's music.
We're not afraid to give a song away digitally, which a lot of majors are still, which is insane.
But Kate's also looking beyond music. The Obama campaign inspired her to bring her managerial skills to the public sector.
I joined the town board. I'm a politician now in my town, and I'm actually running for the county legislator. I hate to say it. I mean, I haven't completely grown up, but I've become a little more mature than that rock and roll vision.
So what happened to Tom Werman, the kingmaker of hair bands? He moved his family to upstate New York to start a bed and breakfast. His turning point came when a friend gave him a picture book for adults called Who Moved My Cheese? Two lab mice discover that the cheese is no longer in the maze. One mouse takes off to find more cheese. The other mouse won't budge until he finds out who's responsible.
And I was that dumb mouse. The whole book was about unanticipated change and how to deal with it. Nobody ever taught us about change, which is the third inevitable thing in your life beside death and taxes. After I finished, I simply put the palm to my forehead like I could have had a V8, and I said, we're out of here. We both lie silently still
in the dead of the night. Right now, with the economic crisis that we're going through, a lot of industries are starting to look like the music industry. The way that people had been getting work, even if they were out of work and where they would expect to find work, it's all changed. And a lot of people feel like that angry mouse who refuses to budge till he finds out who moved his cheese. But it just might be time to leave the maze. But I guess that's why they say every rose has its thorn.
Just like every night has its dawn. That story from independent producer Eric Malinsky. That piece originally aired on Studio 360. This is Sidetrack. The Mississippi River is known by many names. They include the Mighty Mississippi, the Great River, and the Big River. But for one day last month, it was known by another name, the Finish Line. Rich Egger reports on the final day of the Ragbri, the annual 7-day bicycle race across Iowa. Sunshiny day,
yeah, a sunshiny day. A sunshiny day and a party atmosphere greeted bicyclists in Burlington. They headed for the river for the conclusion of Ragbri. The heat in the hills, the wind and the rain of the past week are all forgotten now. It's time to celebrate the 440-mile annual bike ride across Iowa. Ragbri, of course, is a physical challenge. Yeah. Andrew Lynch of Brooklyn, New York, says it's also a mental challenge.
I'm a New Yorker, and camping is not something that enters into daily life.
You don't camp at Central Park, no?
There are people who camp in Central Park, but they're not called campers.
Lynch was invited to Iowa by a buddy who was looking for someone to ride with in Ragbri. Lynch says he's exhausted, but glad he did it.
You know, if there's any way to see Iowa, as the first time in Iowa, I think this is a really cool way to do it.
Come on, shift it to a lower gear, round the snake and go straight up. Come on, go snake alley.
The This year's home stretch featured an extra challenge. Bicyclists could choose to ride up Burlington's Snake Alley.
I cannot make it up that hill.
Let me get back down here.
The brick road rises six stories over a single city block. It twists and turns so much that Ripley's declared it the crookedest street in the world.
I'm skipping it.
Many others also skipped it, but many gave it a shot. Some rode all the way up. Others ended up walking their bikes to the top. Many were exhausted by the time they got there. From there, it was all downhill to the river. Throughout the day, riders crowded the port of Burlington to take part in a Rag-Rye tradition.
You dipping your wheels?
Here's the deal. The ride starts in western Iowa, where bicyclists dip their back tire into the Missouri River. This year, that took place near Council Bluffs. Rag-Rye concludes in eastern Iowa, where riders dip their front tire into the Mississippi. Gary Obadahl and Cheryl Fonley of Iowa City had just one front tire between the two of them. That's because they rode Rag-Rye on a tandem bicycle.
You have to have a lot of communication and a lot of patience.
Yeah,
you got to work together.
We had to really work together. Going up hills, we had to talk to each other and let each other
both
know.
Both people got to work just as strong as the other.
Yeah. Good stoker this year.
Thank you. I always say, you know, it takes the captain, but I'm the admiral. So I'm the boss in the back.
Happy riders pose to have their picture taken at the river.
One, two, three.
Some lifted their bike overhead in triumph. Barb Bentz of Dubuque celebrated by wading into the river for a few minutes.
This water is awesome.
This is her fourth Rag-Rye. Bentz considers it a personal accomplishment to complete the ride.
It's just been an awesome week, ready to go home, get a shower, and sleep in my bed. Get out of the rain.
Some riders wore wacky stuff. For example, a group called Land Sharks attached shark dolls to their helmets. Others added personal touches to their bikes, such as this cow-shaped horn or this boombox on the back of a bike. Organizers say around 10,000 people registered to ride in Rag-Rye. Thousands and thousands more rode along for some or all of it. They came from all 50 states, plus 17 other countries. For some, this was their first Rag-Rye. Others have made the ride ever since it started 37 years ago. What makes Rag-Rye such a huge draw? Many riders say it's the people they meet, not just their fellow riders, but folks in small towns throughout Iowa, people who provide food, water, and shelter for the bike riders as they make their trek across Iowa from west to east, from the Missouri to the Mississippi. Rich Egger reporting.
You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. One of the great things about baseball is that when you go to a game, you may see something you've never seen before. A player hitting for the cycle, a perfect game, an unassisted triple play. Commentator Paul Gaston can top that, and his experience happened during the first Major League game he ever witnessed, 50 years ago.
In my first Major League Baseball game, Chicago, June 1959, I saw something happen that had never happened before during a game. It hasn't happened since, but more on that in a minute. I was 16, traveling by train from Louisiana to Toronto. The Cardinals, my favorite team, were playing the Cubs. This was long before there were lights at Wrigley, of course. I figured out the L, led my friends onto the Howard B. train, and made sure we got off at Addison. We followed the crowd to Wrigley Field, bought our reserve seat tickets, and walked up the dark ramp into the sunshine. The dark red infield dirt, the green ivy on the walls, the sounds of batting practice. I'm not making light of religion when I call that a religious experience. Writer W.P. Kinsella coined a memorable phrase, the thrill of the grass. That says it. But now, that mysterious event. Cardinals versus Cubs. Fourth inning. My hero, Stan Musial, batting. Strike three. But the ball gets by Cubs catcher Sammy Taylor, so Musial takes off for first. Taylor thinks the ball is foul and begins to argue. And for some reason, umpire Vic Delmore drops a new ball into his mitt. Musial knows the original ball is still in play, so he's digging for second. Third baseman Alvin Dark retrieves the original ball and throws to shortstop Ernie Banks, covering second. But Taylor throws the ball he had just been given at the same time. Somehow, Banks manages to catch one of the balls, you couldn't tell which was which, and tag Musial, the other ball, into center field. I'm not finished. Center fielder Bobby Thompson, famous for his 1951 shot heard round the world, tossed what he thought was the extra ball into the dugout to get it out of play. But Musial assumes that the ball Banks had missed was the one in play, so he keeps running and crosses home plate. Imagine the brouhaha. There had been two balls in play at the same time. Which ball had Banks caught? Dark argued it was the one he had thrown. Musial thought otherwise. There had to be a ruling, and the second base umpire eventually called Musial out on the theory that Banks had tagged him with the original ball. But no one really knew. In those days, even if you had wanted to, there was no videotape to run backwards. Well, the Cardinals lost the argument, but they won the game, 4-1. I've seen many a memorable game since, but whenever things get slow, I may say to whoever's in the vicinity, you know, I once saw something at a baseball game that had never happened before and has never happened since. 50 years ago. Umpire Vic Delmore, wherever you are, happy anniversary. I'm Paul Gaston.
Heaney Majeski, Johnny G, Eddie Juiced, Johnny Pesky, Thornton Lee, Danny Gardella, Van Lingle Mungo, Whitey Karowski, Max Lanier, Eddie Waitkus, and Johnny Vandermeer, Bob Estalella, Van Lingle Mungo, Augie Bergamo, Sigmund Jacoki, Big Johnny Mize, and Barney McCoskey, Hal Trosky, Augie Gullan, and Pinky May, Stan Hack and Frenchy Bordagaray, Phil Cavaretta, George McQuinn, Howard Pollett, and Early Wynn, Roy Campanella, Van Lingle Mungo. Augie Bergamo, Sigmund Jacoki, Big Johnny Mize, and Barney McCoskey, Hal Trosky, John Antonelli, Ferris Fane, Frankie Crosetti, Johnny Sane, Harry Brookine, and Lou Boudreaux, Frankie Gustine, and Claude Passo, Eddie Basinski, Ernie Lombardi,
Huey Mulcahy, Van Lingle, Van Lingle Mungo.
You're listening to Sidetrack, the Ferris Wheel, a staple of fairs and amusement parks. Independent producer Nate DeMayo, creator of the podcast The Memory Palace, gives us a little history of this ride.
The French had nailed it. The world loved a World's Fair, and the Exposition Universelle in Paris in 1889 just killed. The exhibits in the grounds were unparalleled and impeccable. And at the center of it all was this audacious steel structure that managed to be imposing and elegant and the tallest thing on earth and unmistakably French all at once. Paris had the Eiffel Tower. And the men planning the next fair, the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, just a couple of years away, needed something that good. Something Eiffel Tower good. And that wasn't easy to find. The proposals ran from the ridiculous, like a structure that would soar more than 2,000 feet above the land of Lincoln, made entirely of stacked logs and topped with a replica of Abe's boyhood home, to the extra ridiculous, something so tall that visitors would take an elevator to the top and then sit in a slide that would drop them off in New York or San Francisco. The fair's organizers were in a panic. They demanded that America's designers and engineers step up. And a man named George Ferris stepped forward. When his Ferris wheel was completed that summer, it rose 264 feet above the ground, which was a lot shorter than the Eiffel Tower, but that thing didn't even move. And the idea that something that was so massive, but that looked so fragile, like a bicycle wheel whose spokes looked too thin to keep a bike up, was thrilling and kind of terrifying. Despite what the engineers said, despite the math and laws of physics, despite the assurances of the people running the fair, there were people who were sure that this ludicrous machine was going to be a disaster, that people were going to die. Not only was there no way that that flimsy thing was going to be able to stand up to a prairie wind or a gale off the lake, even if it did, the prospect of tumbling through the air in a cage 20 stories above Chicago was craziness. Who in their right mind is going to want to ride that thing? Hundreds of thousands of people did, despite the fact that during its test run, thousands of bolts and loose parts rained down on spectators below, despite real stories of panicked riders trying to escape through the windows when they realized exactly how high 200 feet was, despite apocryphal stories of suicides and severed limbs, this Ferris wheel, this thing that's basically a kiddie ride today, it was a bigger thrill ride than any quintuple loop open car reverse twist rocket coaster that they might have at Six Flags. But moreover, it was an entirely new human experience. The newspapers, even some in France, said it was the marvel of the age, better than the Eiffel Tower. And it was a Ferris wheel. That almost mundane sensation we have now of looking down from above and moving through space, up and out and down and around again. No one had ever felt those things before. And of course now, we can't really feel those things again. We've gone around too many times. We've looped too many loops. But back in 1893, you could pay your 50 cents and climb into a car right after sunset during the golden hour and experience something entirely new. And you could rise up far above the World's Fair, where down below, Americans were eating hamburgers for the first time. Where entire villages from Egypt and Algeria had been brought to the middle of America and reconstructed. And you could come back to Earth and walk out of the car and be among the first people on Earth to walk around at night with lights on. But fairs end. They shut down and pack up and leave town. And the Ferris wheel did too. Moved to a different park on the north side of Chicago. And it was fun for a while, but after a while the novelty was gone. And they tore it down. And a salvage company bought it for $8,000 and blew it up with dynamite and sold the pieces for scrap.
That feature from independent producer Nate DeMayo, To hear more of his stories, visit thememorypalace.us. Still to come, we revisit an interview about superheroes as society's new gods and taking on a bully for the first time at age 33. Stay tuned. You're tuned to Sidetrack. Recently, the San Diego Comic-Con wrapped up. This annual event is the pinnacle of comic book and pop culture. For many, superheroes are more than just muscular characters who wear capes and fight evil. In fact, they have become a pantheon of new gods. That's what author Christopher Knowles argues in his book, Our Gods Wear Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes. It's published by Weiser Books. I talked with Knowles back in 2007. In his book, Knowles traces superheroes back to ancient gods and secret societies. I asked him to give a quick overview of this history.
What I'm basically doing is sort of, the way I wrote the book is I worked backwards. And I was looking at what was going on in fandom and noticing that it kind of was very reminiscent of a lot of things I read about ancient, you know, festivals of the gods and the mystery religions and things like that. And also, a visit to the Metropolitan Museum in New York to the Egyptian wing showed that the Egyptians sort of had action figures and posters and, you know, the hieroglyphs and the scrolls, which basically read like comic books. You know, you had words and pictures used in sequence and whatnot. And the way comics have evolved and the way fandom has evolved is that the treatment of superheroes in today's comics is extremely reverential. It's very serious, it's very solemn, and the characters are taken very seriously these days. And this filters down into the artwork, which is often photorealistic and often painted. So I was wondering what happened in the past 20 years where you had sort of a goofy, cartoony medium that all of a sudden became very solemn and serious, and the subject matter started becoming much more serious, and the way the characters were treated was much more reverential. And that's the genesis of the book, and I started poking around in things that I've read over the years, this crossover between people involved in, you know, pulp fiction and occult fiction and these secret societies and whatnot, and just started connecting the dots, and there was a lot of dots to connect.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about this reverential side between the fans and the comic books. You actually refer to these big comic book conventions as the Church of the Superhero.
Yeah, and other things as well. I mean, superhero, we're not just talking, you know, your standard Batman, Superman, Spider-Man. I mean, you have a lot of characters coming in from science fiction television. You have from movies, from video games, from manga and anime. So you have a whole host these characters, but really the roots of them all spring from the superheroes. And the superheroes themselves spring from their proto-superheroes of the pulps, the pulp magazines of the 20s and 30s. You had characters like the Shadow and the Avenger and the Spider and Doc Savage. And essentially, the two prototypical superheroes of the modern age are Superman and Batman, and Superman is essentially Doc Savage. And Batman is essentially the Shadow, both of which were pulp characters. So it's just an evolutionary process that's taken place over the years.
Well, you refer to these modern superheroes kind of like new gods. I think that's a terminology you actually use.
Well, that terminology is taken from an actual comic book series from
Jack Kirby.
From Jack Kirby, called The New Gods. And Kirby was very much obsessed with mythology. It was his lifeblood, and he very much saw what he was doing in comics as, you know, he, almost like the new Homer, you know, or the new Bard of the modern world. He said that the tribes would tell these stories that would be passed on over the years, and that modern society really had no equivalent to that. So what he was trying to do with his comics, and I think Stan Lee, his partner in the 60s, would attest to this as well, is that they were trying to create something that would be the equivalent of the 12 Labors of Hercules, or Jason and the Argonauts, or Beowulf, or Gilgamesh, these stories, these great mythic stories, these heroes who were demigods in a way. And then some of the roots of those stories where you had things like the contentions of Horus and Set, which was basically a superhero story between Horus, the sun god, and Set, the god of night and chaos. And that story, you know, was, you know, they would shapeshift and they would race stone boats and somebody would pluck out their eye and would, you know, become a lotus plant. It was, the imagery was very familiar to me as somebody who grew up reading comics.
Well, why do we need these new gods, to paraphrase the Jack Kirby world, in place of these older figures and these older stories?
Well, the older stories just don't really apply anymore. The context is totally different. For instance, I mean, even with the pulp characters took place in a world before commercial air travel, before the internet, before television, before satellites. You know, this world where the world was very huge, and if you were living on a farm in Kansas and you were reading about somebody's adventures in the Mayan ruins of Central America, and this was incredibly exotic to you, and, you know, just a new experience entirely. And today, that doesn't really have the same punch. I mean, you know, Jason and, you know, assembling the greatest heroes of the Greek world to, you know, cruise around the Mediterranean in this wooden boat doesn't really mean much to people anymore. And today, you know, when we have this specter of terrorism and war, we have much more important things to worry about, and we have much more pressing threats. And the kind of anxieties that are very prevalent in society today have been playing themselves out in comics for a very long time.
Well, it seems when times are bad, the popularity of superheroes goes up.
Absolutely.
And then when times are good, they kind of fade into the background.
Mm-hmm. That's something that you see throughout history, yeah.
And so you think that we're in one of these times when we need the heroes?
Absolutely. I mean, everyone feels threatened. Everyone feels powerless. Everyone sort of feels like that geek in high school gym class who's picked last for the team. I mean, everybody feels vulnerable in the world. Everybody feels expendable. And that is a very disempowering feeling for people to experience. So what superhero fantasy does, both explicitly in comics and in video games and in movies, and also this new breed of superhero fantasy where we're seeing things like the Bionic Woman, heroes, shows like the 4400, Kyle XY, and then the Superman Smallville soap opera, sort of plain clothes superheroes, in a way. We're seeing sort of more accessible superhero fantasy becoming very popular. And the reason this is striking a chord is that reality is enough. You know, we've got enough bad news in the world. We've got enough reality. We've got enough grim portents, and I think what people are looking for is an escape from that, and also an escape into something empowering, something liberating. And that's where I think where superhero fantasy comes in.
Now, some might say, to paraphrase Freud, sometimes a man in a cape is just a man in a cape. Do superheroes really need to have these deeper meanings?
Well, I'm a Jungian, and I write from a Jungian perspective. So Freud actually would keep statues of the ancient gods on his desk, and that wasn't very well known until recently. No, everything has a deeper meaning. Everything that people respond to, they respond to for a reason. A man in a cape flying is very silly and not very important. And the basic premise of superheroes is so preposterous. There has to be a very compelling reason why people are drawn to the fantasy. So, no, I totally disagree with that. I think that there's always a reason.
Now, in your book, Our Gods Wear Spandex, you talk about some of the archetypes and which hero fits where. So I'm going to give you some of the big heroes, and you kind of tell me where they fit into this whole idea. Let's go with the two big ones from, let's do a couple from the Golden Age, Superman and Captain Marvel, the original Captain Marvel.
Yeah, both of them are messiahs. Messiahs are characters, often otherworldly, who act out of a sense of greater purpose or altruism. Siegel and Schuster drew very heavily upon biblical stories to develop Superman, and Captain Marvel sort of came more from the mystery tradition, mysticism, and the occult, particularly Freemasonry. Captain Marvel's creation is very much drawn from Masonic symbolism and Masonic ritual.
Okay, well, let's go to another big character, Batman. Of course, he's been around since the late 30s. Where does he fit in?
Batman is a golem. Now, the golem comes from the Jewish tradition, Kabbalah mysticism, and not the Madonna variety, medieval mysticism, stories of a rabbi in Prague who created the golem to protect the community and soon became a threat to the community. Golems are characters who act out of a sense of revenge, a sense of righting wrongs, but often are dangerous, are often anti-heroes, and often become a threat to the communities that they're meant to protect. These aspects are very prevalent in Batman stories, particularly of the past 20 years, where Batman is seen as a loose cannon, as an obsessive, as a near sociopath. So Batman fits very comfortably into the golem archetype.
And Wonder Woman, of course, being an example of an Amazon.
Yeah, literally an Amazon. Her creator was an interesting character who invented the polygraph, was a polygamist, and was obsessed with reintroducing these Greco-Roman mythology archetypes back into culture. She's literally an Amazon, comes from the island of Amazon, and is a princess. But she's also, interestingly enough, she's also sort of a golem because she's made of clay, and Aphrodite, the goddess Aphrodite, breathes life into her.
Now, you tie in superheroes with occultism, and it's not a hard thing to connect the dots with that one, because in the Golden Age there were a lot of magical and mystical characters.
And much more today as well.
And a lot, that came out of the 70s and more today. Why do you think that's such a potent combination?
Well, because it's the ultimate superpower, isn't it? Occult or magical powers are sort of a magical hat where you can pull out any kind of superpower you want. You've got characters like Doctor Strange, who are the magicians, and can basically fly or travel through time or travel through dimensions or sort of conjure up any sort of power they wish.
Well, even a character like Harry Potter can fit
into absolutely.
That.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of people don't know this, but Harry Potter is very clearly drawn from a comic book character called Timothy Hunter, who was created by Neil Gaiman, who created The Sandman.
You mentioned Neil Gaiman, who is in this new generation of writers, along with people like Alan Moore and Alex Ross, who are very conscious of the superhero myth and very conscious of the things that you trace, the origins, the old gods, these old stories. How did that come about, and how does this continue to show itself?
Well, essentially what it is that it's just a return to the roots. What we're seeing is just a return to first principles. Comic books and superheroes have gone in many different directions, gone down many different blind alleys, a lot of tangents. And what Alan Moore and Alex Ross and Neil Gaiman and Grant Morrison and a host of other people did is they just went back in time and saw that the early superheroes were just direct adaptations of the ancient Greco-Roman gods or Egyptian gods, read those stories, were familiar with the stories, read how these stories were sort of revived in the late Victorian era, and then just started, like I do, connecting the dots.
Well, you were mentioning how these guys have breathed new life into the superhero genre. You actually talk in the book how in the late 90s, a lot of people kind of were dismissing comic books, kind of throwing them by the wayside because they were all style and no substance.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then you talk about this this series called Kingdom Come that you feel really brought this reverence for superheroes back.
Yeah, and I'm just think of that title, Kingdom Come. It's from the Lord's Prayer. That book is just filled with religious imagery. The protagonist of the story is actually a preacher. The facilitator of the story is the Spectre, who was created by Jerry Siegel, who created Superman, and was described as being as close to God as you could get in comic books. The story is very much an apocalypse, and it's very much an anti-heretical tract. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the first and second century screeds by early Christian fathers, I mean, you're going to find the exact same energy. Alex Ross was a preacher's son, so he had that background to draw upon. And he was disgusted. He was extremely, extremely outraged by what was happening to superheroes. And he very much saw them as gods. He describes very much as what he's doing as being religious. And, you know, you get into some dicey areas there because, you know, you don't want to see people bowing and praying to Superman. But it's a different kind of thing. It's a mythology. It's very much the way, the learned peoples of the ancient world saw the ancient gods. They didn't see these as literal stories or literal beings. They saw them as representative of forces of nature. And, people, the way Freud and Jung sort of saw this material later on in the early 20th century. So that Kingdom Come is sort of the touchstone. It's sort of the year zero of new comics, of the new comics reverence of these godlike heroes.
Well, and the interesting thing about that series is basically the world is ruled by these second-rate, second- and third-generation superheroes who are making a mess of things. So the big guys from the Golden Age have to come back and set things right.
Yeah, and they just, I mean, if you look at the imagery, it's so blatant. I mean, they come from the heart of the sun, they descend from the heavens. I mean, it's very exalted. It's very mythological. It's self-consciously mythological. I mean, it's very, I'll tell you something. I mean, I was not a huge fan of DC superheroes when I was a kid, but I was very, I was very moved by that story. And these weren't characters that I particularly cared for when I was young. So,
where do we go from here?
That's a very important question. It depends largely on where society goes. Comics have always been sort of hostage to the direction of the society at large. So if we continue in the way we're going, where we have a great deal of anxiety, a great deal of fear, a great deal of uncertainty, I think that comic books and superheroes are going to continue to. So, I mean, I think that we're going to see a continuing amount of energy put into this medium and put into this, this genre.
That was Christopher Knowles, author of Our Gods Wear Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes. It's published by Wiser Books. That interview originally aired on the November 2007 edition of Sidetrack. This is Sidetrack. During his formative years, independent producer Chris Bolton survived a fair amount of bullying. But at age 33, he felt compelled for the first time to stand up to a bully with his own two fists. It all happened at a small bar called Valentine's in Portland, Oregon. Here's the story.
There was rarely a day in junior high or high school that I didn't dwell in fear of some imminent grief at the hands of one of my peers. I was one of those kids who, for a variety of reasons, was shunned by the majority of the adolescent pack, and like my fellow outcasts, sometimes fell prey to a particular breed of social predator known commonly as the bully. The archetypal bully singles out those who have no support network, no social standing. A bully requires conspirators, or at least an audience, so that his or her acts of bullying are witnessed and appreciated by others. I used to dream of going back in time by a few days or even a few years in order to rescue my defeated self, so that when I was struck, slapped, pinched, teased, or laughed at, instead of shying away or making awkward attempts at self-defense, I would strike heroically back at my enemy, winning the day for all to see. As an adult, I've been fortunate enough to inhabit a life where I've rarely had to deal with people who bully others. So I was surprised a few months back to find myself facing real-life bullies once again, and more so impressed with how familiar it all seemed, my heart racing, my mind's gears grinding as I shifted anxiously between fight and flight. But there was also this opportunity, perhaps a selfish one, to act on my own heroic fantasies, to take something back from all the bullies who'd abused me in the past. I've separately interviewed my friends, Nora.
Sometimes I wish I wasn't so nosy. Yeah.
John.
Oh, don't worry, we're not going to fight. Like, that's ridiculous. I just get excited about politics and I want to argue. But...
And Avery.
And there was an awesome dance party going on.
In order to help tell this story.
Valentine's is a tiny little
Valentine's
club.
Is a bar.
So Valentine's is like this club.
And a tiny little street that I think only goes in Portland.
That opened up a couple years ago, and it's...
Downtown, where they have shows.
Super small and
nestled in a little alleyway around like a bunch of other bars that are like...
And sometimes they have shows, and sometimes they have DJs.
It's got stuff we like. Music and cheap,
like arty
drinks.
People or musicians that go there. Because downtown seems like it's been taken over by, especially on a Friday or Saturday night, by, you know, people from the suburbs coming in.
With the kind of suburban miniskirt.
Getting wasted and driving around in these
and heels,
stretch SUVs
and cologne, I don't know, crowd.
Fighting or something.
I was there because it was my roommate Becky's 35th birthday, and
my girlfriend Nora met me downtown. Actually, I called you as we were going there to see what you were doing.
Yeah, at around the time that the bar started to fill up, you and John and Nora showed up.
Of our other friends, Avery was there.
But it was super packed that night because there was a DJ. There were two DJs who played wildly different music, but it was very crowded. And for a small space, it was very warm and stuffy.
Was it a Saturday night?
I think it was a Friday night.
It was a Saturday night, and I don't normally go downtown on Saturday nights, but it seemed okay. It wasn't, like, too overwhelming, but it was okay.
There's really no room in Valentine's for a dance party. And I was dancing with Becky because she was making me, because it was her birthday and she wanted to dance.
So everyone was good. I think we had all had a couple of drinks. John had left to eat.
I left. I went across, like, a block away to Dante's to get a slice of pizza.
There were these two dudes. They have to be dudes, because they were such dudes.
There was a bigger guy.
One was tall, one was kind of short. I think the tall guy was wearing, like, a navy, like, peacoat.
He was, like, a leather jacket wearing gel-haired guy.
And they had, like, collared shirts and super clean cut.
And then there was, like, a littler guy who was, like, maybe a little stocky. That's all I remember about them.
They were sort of milling around, and they just had this... I don't know, this sounds so West Coast. It's like, ew, vibe. Like, you are not milling in a socially productive way. And then I heard from you, Chris, that...
You came up to me.
They were saying things to people that were like, oh,
and
you.
Said that there were these creeps who had just showed up that were...
So he's talking about people's sexuality, like calling people fags and...
Like giving girls a hard time.
Asking about sexual acts. So I got...
Just like being jerks to everybody.
Whenever I have too much wine, I get very nosy. And I think that I can change something or do something about it and I have to be involved. So I got really nosy and started like following them and listening. And it was true. They were saying horrible things to people.
The door guy wouldn't let me in with the pizza, so I sat outside and ate my slice.
So I said, you know, do you have to say things like that? Blah, blah, blah. And I tried to de-escalate.
Nora was, I think, yelling at them.
I can do this. I'll just talk to him and then we'll leave. I'll ask him why he's saying, they were the blonde one, why he's saying these things to these people and what is the purpose? Why are you even here?
And then I came back in. And I noticed that Nora was standing. We had all been sitting at this table, but she was standing now, and there were these two guys.
And then there was a little voice in my head that said, Nora, stop. He will not stop. Just go back. Have fun. And I didn't listen to it. I just shut it up. And around that time when I was like, wah, 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 John came back from pizza.
You know, I've had a few drinks. So initially I'm like, "What? Who are those guys? What's going on?" It seemed like Nora had been in sort of a heated conversation with them.
So I remember being nervous. Like, I was nervous when John came back. Like, oh, dear.
You know, it's kind of blurry exactly what happened. But
we were all talking about John McCain, which just seems absurd in the whole string of things.
Next thing I know, we're talking about the election. And
talking about John McCain is not going to be good because he won't be able to resist a conversation about John McCain.
I started getting heated about it. And was
he's
like,
tipsy. And now he's well-fed because he just went out to eat.
John was kind of... So... You could tell that he was getting, like, a little bit, like, puffed up about it.
So I was just like, oh, we're talking about politics. Yeah, all right. Let's get, you know, into an argument. Whatever. It didn't seem that, like, I was going to turn violent. So finally I was like, well, maybe this isn't the best situation for me to be in. Maybe I should sit down. So I sat down, and I think Nora sat down beside me. So I think I said, you know, what do you make a lot of money? Is that why you're going to vote for John McCain? You know,
one of these guys,
as he gets up to leave,
had reached across the table and slashed
me in the face.
like a little bug, like just got whacked, like he was an insect or something, and he did not respond well, and there was this kerfuffle,
and I was just,
and they started
like,
to get escorted out, and then I was watching because I was so nosy. There's sort of like a frenzy of angry bees around them. People were just all like watching. And then Chris Bolton.
I was standing not 10 steps from where this was all happening. I was fuming at the cockiness of these jerks. It was in those last few minutes when the shorter guy was being escorted out and a taller guy took the pot shot at John that I reached a boiling point. Avery will tell you I tapped him on the shoulder.
I saw you tap this guy on the shoulder.
But that's not what happened. I lacked any sort of tactical intelligence in my angered state. As soon as John was hit, I was suddenly following my own fist across the room as if it had its own private trajectory.
And when he turned around,
here's his hand and punches
him. You socked him right in the face and sent him flying into the table.
And that's when you hit him, I guess.
Which is so silly. And John is like chasing after and trying to swat back and get that last swat in.
After I hit him, the fight drained out of me immediately. It was an uncanny feeling, intimate almost. The sensation of this guy's stubble on my fist, it resonated with me. I was embarrassed, but I was also triumphant. I'd fought a bully and won.
Everyone in the, you know, the bar completely erupted, and everyone started holding this guy back.
I mean, it was kind of like a room full of people who aren't bullies, like turning on the bullies and being like, well, it's on now,
the
you
bouncer
know.
Comes over, like, so. The bartender comes over, and they're trying to shuffle these guys out the
and
door.
And then it just seemed like a celebration. Like, ah, they're out. And there was a punch. Chris punched someone, and it was awesome. And I didn't want to have another drink, but I felt like I had to, because it was like something to celebrate. It was this like momentous occasion.
And so it was really funny moment when after you punched this dude out, then you kind of just turned around and had this like kind of moment where you're like, how about that?
But I remember dancing after and feeling pretty good, and then checking to see if they were outside, being kind of tough, like, are they outside?
And then they repeatedly made attempts to get back into Valentine's.
And then the bouncer said they're still kind of out there. They've been circling around.
The door guy was like, well, I'm going to walk you guys to your bikes. Because...
You did have to be escorted out because those dudes were waiting for you guys outside.
So we got escorted out of Valentine's, which is so silly. Like getting escorted out, A, and then out of Valentine's, B, which makes it even more ridiculous. So we got walked to our bikes. And sure enough, they were there. They were out there. My bike ride home was scary. We were feeling, like, scared and excited. Like, when you're a teenager watching a scary movie, it's, like, super awesome. But you're still kind of scared because you could get, like, swatted on your bike or something. But it was a really exciting night. My adrenaline was, like... But I didn't hit anyone. But my adrenaline was still super high.
I don't think I have ever seen a bar fight in Portland, living here for eight years. If there's anyone who I would never expect to be in a bar fight, it would be you.
We were very excited. I feel like we were excited for like 24 hours about violence, about assaulting someone. It was great. I still feel good about it. I don't know what that says about me, but I'm still excited about it.
I don't think that violence is, you know, going to solve anything, but I mean, I don't know how hard you hit him. Maybe he felt something in the morning in his jaw, but to get, like, hit a couple times and thrown out and then be out in the street, like, I mean, I guess I hope they felt sort of humiliated, but, you know, is that going to change their attitude? I don't know.
And I think it tied into presidential election. Like, it was so perfect that John McCain was a part of it. And then the people involved, it was just, like, it was very symbolic. It was right. Violence at that moment was appropriate and right. It was good.
I'm open to the idea that what I did was wrong and probably poorly thought out. But sometimes the currents and themes and stories in our lives seek their own resolution. When I lifted my fist that night, it was against every stupid bully who's ever made me or my friends feel small.
Go to the bar now, and I'm like, where's the bar fight? I don't know. I guess this is for me to work out on my own, in my own time, about my sentiments about alcohol-induced violence, or how I feel about revenge, or whatever. But yeah, I don't have any regrets, or... Sometimes I wish I wasn't so nosy. Yeah. What can you do?
So you're a personal Waterloo now. Well, fine, well, fine, well, fine for your musicals and dying cities. They'll fight, they'll fight, they'll fight for your neural walls and plasticities. And precious territory, and precious territory, and precious territory.
That story from independent producer Chris Bolton. We also heard from his friends John Willett, Nora Dalanovich, and Avery Thatcher. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.